Our guest today is Mike Erickson, W1WHN. That's a call sign. And obviously you're from out east, so you're familiar with the old station WHN. Was that intentional, or did you want that call?
No, that's a vanity call. That was totally intentional.
Totally.
My original call was KC2, and this is serious. KC2 MFU. I'm serious.
They sent you that call sign.
They actually sent me KC2MFU.
I guess I'd get rid of that one, too. You know, what's really weird about vanity calls, you know, it's almost like, you know, people's real names, you know, like an actor has a real name and then their stage name, you know, the stage name always has more cosmetic value to it than, like, Bob Schwartz or something like that, you know. And so I think vanity calls kind of fall into that a little bit. Same thing, you know. It's kind of like, you know.
I've known some people who have, like, I know someone out here who has W1CC up in Connecticut, is a big fan of the radio station WICC. So he has a vanity license plate, and it looks like WICC, but it's Whiskey 1 Charlie. So, you know, radio people get strange vanity calls, you know, some for their initials. My friend Jerry took his father's calls after he passed away, WA2FNQ. So it's cool. You know, I like vanity calls.
You got into amateur radio. Tell the story. How did you get in? And first off, let me just say this. Mike is a broadcast engineer, okay, and worked for several radio stations out east there in New York City and whatnot, and now works for the Wheatstone Corporation. And involved in a number of things with that company, including their audio processor, this new Air Aura, which is quite an incredible machine. But anyhow, let's start off with your beginnings in ham radio. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, when I graduated from elementary school, a friend of mine actually bought me his old Bearcat 210 scanner and a sheet of paper that had all the local listings for the police frequency. So I had them all programmed into the scanner, and I used to sit, especially on Friday and Saturday nights, I used to sit at home because I was 13, 14 years old and couldn't find a date if I wanted to, and I would listen to the police calls on Suffolk County, Long Island, and I was actually intrigued that I felt like I was, like, really out there and, you know, actually where it was happening, and I used to look forward to doing that, just listening to the police calls and just hearing all the crazy things that were going on out there while I was, like, you know, hold up in my house. You know, when you think about listening to the police scanner and all the things that you could be involved with if you're out there, it's actually kind of frightening, especially for someone, you know, who was a teenager at the time and, you know, didn't have a lot of worldly knowledge and didn't understand half the things he was listening to. But one Sunday I found one of the features on the scanner. This was an old 70s Bearcat, didn't have the manual, so it was kind of like I was finding my way through using it. Just by chance, I hit the scan button and it went down, and all of a sudden I heard this, what sounded like a telephone conversation. Only one person was talking, and then they would, you know, say what I thought was just some code or something, and then, you know, the radio would squelch, and then another guy would come on and start talking, and I thought this was even cooler because I'm eavesdropping on someone's phone conversations, and I didn't realize until I went to see my friend again who gave me the scanner. I said, I heard these people talking. He's like, oh, you must have hit upon a 2-meter repeater. And I said, what's that? And he's like, well, ham radio is it's a service that where people, you know, communicate with one another. It's point-to-point communication, and you know, you apply for a license by taking a test, and when you pass, you know, you get a license, and you can go buy a radio, and you can talk to other ham radios on the air. And he started talking about simplex and repeaters and all sorts of stuff, and I thought it was kind of interesting. And he said, you know, if you want to start, and then he handed me one of his old CBs. He's like, you can check this out. You know, you used to have a license for this, but, you know, now you can go on the air and talk to anyone you want. You don't need a license. And I discovered CB first, and then I eventually graduated to to getting my amateur license. Actually, it was ended up being many years later. It ended up being one of those things where I always wanted to do it. I just never sat down and actually took the time. And about 8-9 years ago, I finally decided that, you know, I wanted to. And then I was, and after I got it, my wife Stephanie got her ham license, and a couple other people I know, my friend Kyle Cradigal, who's a young disc jockey on Long Island. I was his Elmer, and he got his ham license when he was 13 years old. So it was pretty cool. I love amateur radio. I'm actually kind of sad here in North Carolina because I don't really hear any activity on the VHF bands. I don't have anything set up for HF, but I don't hear any activity here on the VHF bands, and it's kind of disheartening moving from Long Island to North Carolina, where in Long Island we had a net every night. We had a late owl, night owl net every night that ran from 11 o'clock to about 2, 3 in the morning, and I used to jump on that with the Suffolk Police Amateur Radio Club and the HBO Amateur Radio Club. And it was kind of cool to be on these nets late, and, you know, I used to do it every night and was a companion if I was out late doing engineering things somewhere. And it's kind of sad that I really don't hear anyone on here. I throw out my calls every now and then, and I never hear anyone come back. So I'm kind of disheartened that there's not a lot of activity here
Carolina. Do you have EchoLink?
Yes, I don't have EchoLink on my current netbook. I do have EchoLink on my home PC, but I travel so much for work that I really don't have time to sit and do EchoLink, and I wish I did, but I really don't have time I really haven't found the time to sit and do EchoLink, and that's something that I should really.
Well, you can do it. You can do it on your smartphone.
Really?
Yeah.
That I didn't know.
Do you have a Droid?
I have a BlackBerry.
I don't know about the BlackBerry. I know on the Droids, and I believe on the iPhones, you can download, and it's probably. For the BlackBerry, but you can download the app, and boy, I mean, it works. I mean, it works extremely well. And there's a little test thing you can, you know, you test your audio to see how the audio is doing and whatnot. But one thing I have found, and this is something I want to touch on because what you brought up here is something that I really believe. You know, it's strange that you bring this up because this is something that really has been on my mind, and that is if you get on EchoLink even, you can look and look and look. You can't find people talking on repeaters. I mean, it just isn't there. You drive across country, and you got a radio on, and the conversations and QSOs are sparse.
I wonder how much of the internet age has kind of like, and I know this is weird because there's nothing more enjoyable than actually keying a mic, putting your calls out there, and then having a conversation over the air with someone. And I wonder how much of the internet has taken some of that away, just the way we communicate through text messages, through BBM, through chat rooms. You know, I wonder how much that has taken away from the, you know, the ability to communicate over the air and have people, you know, just, I guess it might be easier to put a computer on or just have a cell phone and be able to talk to someone. But at the same time, that's you know, you can never replace that over the air conversation or that QSO with a text message. It's not even close to being the same.
Well, you know, I guess I want to say back, you got into Citizens Band originally, and where I'm originally from in the Detroit area, Citizens Band was like a, oh, I don't know, it was like a little community gathering, you know. People would get on, say, CB, and they would talk back and forth. Of course, they use handles and whatnot, but they still, let me say that it was a community. It was an enjoyable thing. It was the radio was on, and you basically just left the radio on all the time, you know. And people would pass by their radios and sit down, talk for a few minutes, get up, go do something else, you know. And I remember, you know, ham radio being that way. Years ago, you'd have a receiver, a transceiver parked on one frequency, and you'd just leave it there, and people would come and go, especially at night on 75 meters. You would have groups of people. You'd get to know those groups of people, you know. And I don't know that do you really think the technology has changed it? I mean, I don't see how text messaging could compete with, you know, just sitting down and talking. I, you know, I wonder, is it a matter of people don't have time anymore? Are you needing a place to put up a website? Have you looked around? You want to do something that's easy, that's simple, and very, very inexpensive, but yet looks professional? Are you having troubles with your computer? Do you need some tech support help? Are you tired of being connected to India every time you pick up the telephone to get some help on a machine or on a website? The people to call is tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. T-U-X, like tuxedo, dash support, the word support, .com. These are the people to call. They can get you going. It won't cost you an arm and a leg. You can afford to work with these folks. They're professionals. They answer in plain English, and they can help you do things from a very, very basic, simple standpoint. If you have something that you want to do that's a complex project, well, they can handle that as well. But if you're like I am, when you're trying to put something up on the web or you need help with the computer, you really want somebody that speaks English. And you want it to be simple, and you don't want to have to pay an arm and a leg for it. And you want to deal with some good folks. Go to their website, tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. This reminder from PrayForMe.us. If you have a need in your life and you need someone to pray for you, go to the website PrayForMe.us. That's PrayForMe.us. You can remain anonymous, use a nickname, or just your first name. There's no financial requirements and no personal information needed. It's just people praying for people. If you have a need, go to PrayForMe.us. That's PrayForMe.us. Here at QSO, we really need to hear from you. We would appreciate it if you would go to our website, QSORadioshow.com. That's QSORadioshow.com. Send us an email from the website and put on that email, I want to win, because we're constantly giving neat things away. QSORadioshow.com. Also, we'd appreciate it if you would follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And if you'd friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show. We'd love to hear from you. Be sure and do an email to us and put on that email, I want to win. You know, I don't know.
Part of it might be time, but part of it might be just that there's not a lot of, you know, the influx of younger people may not be there anymore. I mean, I know, not to say that there aren't, you know, young hams anymore, and there are, but I mean, you have to wonder, not that, and as I said, not that text messaging would ever replace being on the air and being able to, you know, make a contact, but you just wonder if, like, and I think maybe a lot of it is people just don't have the time as, you know, technology's advanced and the world, you know, everything's become faster and faster and more immediate. You know, people take on more responsibilities, take on more work, and, you know, at the end of the day, you know, they're just falling down and they don't want to. You know, they just, you know, they look at the radio and like, and they don't even want to turn it on. It's interesting because the only time I hear the airwaves like really full of people is if there's a contest or, you know, like a field day event or something like that. And it's kind of disturbing that these repeaters sit pretty much dormant so often. And I totally agree with you. In you know, even 10, 15, 20 years ago, you turn the CB on, you could have a meaningful conversation. Nowadays, you put the CB radio on, it's like this vast wasteland of just people screaming at the top of their lungs with, you know, with reverbed mics and everything. It's, you know, just trying to, you know, just make noise on the band.
Well, I think Bob Heil needs to make a good reverb mic for 2 meters. What do you think?
I know a friend who has reverb on 2 meters. He has in his home studio, he has a little hint of reverb on his microphone. He's using a Heil mic, and he's got a little Yamaha reverb, and he's got a little Inovonics limiter, and it's all wired into his Yaesu.
Yeah, and you know, Bob Heil is a advocate of this. You know, Dayton every year they have that Heil Alley where he sells the microphones, and then there's all these people with mic mixers and little audio processors and all kinds of stuff that you hook up to your radio, you know. And of course, there's a lot of these guys that are into AM, and they're loving all that. They love hooking up all these gadgets and EQing everything, and you know, using these dynamic microphones and EQing the daylights out of them. So I don't know. I mean, that's just that's a thing. But you know, okay, activity wise, here's the thing I don't get though. What I don't get, and that is, we've got it here in the Nashville area, and I'm sure it's everywhere. There are those people, though, that don't want you operating on a repeater. Have you had them around where you're at? I mean, you get on, and it's like, you know, I mean, I've heard we had kids here that were the school of the blind attending here, and they had got their ham tickets, and they were up on the 70 centimeter band, and just chewing the fat, and all of a sudden this guy comes on and says, you need to get off of here because the National Weather Service is monitoring this frequency, and they just don't want to hear you talking. And not a cloud in the sky, and he's a bunch of blind kids. You know, and I see that, and I think to myself, why are we allowing this? You know, why do we allow this to happen? Because I think it's wrong. Okay, now you disagree with me if you...
No, actually, I don't. I haven't experienced it. I've heard of it, but I have not actually experienced or heard myself. But I don't think it's right. I think, especially if it's young people, you know, if they show interest in the hobby, I think they should only be encouraged to participate in ham radio. I think what it does when someone gets on and says something like that discourages them. I mean, that only drives them away, makes them feel like that they can't use the repeater, and the repeater is there for, you know, anyone who needs to use it. You know, it would be another thing if there was, you know, clouds were gathering in the, you know, and there was a funnel cloud coming out of the sky. That's one thing. But, you know, on a bright sunny day, when, you know, what's the harm in using the repeater if someone's dialing around, if you're an amateur and you're dialing around, and you don't like what you're listening to, or, you know, or it's annoying or something, as long as that the people who are on are not being mischievous or are not using the repeater in an incorrect manner, then just tune away.
Okay, well, the other thing I don't understand, I do not understand the concept of closed repeaters. Now, let me explain why I say that. I know it costs a lot of money to put a repeater on the air. It's a major investment upon the part, especially if it's an individual. So the individual may decide, I want to put a repeater on here, but you know what? I only want a certain people on here. I only want just a few of my friends on here, and I don't want this thing to be all that busy and all that kind of stuff. So I'm putting PL Tone on it, and it's a closed repeater, okay? But you know what? There's something really wrong with that, because even if you're spending the money to do it, the frequency does not belong to you.
I totally agree.
The frequency is a public thing. It belongs to everyone. And I believe if you're going to put a machine on the air, and you're going to pay the money and take the risk, then you might as well, I mean, I guess I want to say you should be made to accommodate all radio amateurs on that frequency. If you're going to throw your hat in the ring, then be prepared for the responsibility that goes with it.
Right.
I think this whole idea of a closed repeater is smug, it's arrogant, and I believe it takes away from the hobby.
Yeah.
So I just don't want that kind of people up here. Well, you know what? Then maybe you don't need to be running a repeater. You know, because you know, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, of course, I don't use the things. I mean, I really don't. I don't get on VHF very much. Very seldom do I get on VHF. And I get on, or UHF, either one. Here in town, there's one or two machines that are very friendly and open, and I use those. But I've been in places where I've been yelled at for just signing my call on a repeater, just getting out there and saying, hey, this is WB8PUM monitoring. And someone, are you a member? No, I'm just passing through the area. You know, I've had repeaters shut off for that reason, you know, and it brings me around. Boy, I'm on a soapbox now. See, something you said set me off. I think it's time for radio amateurs as a whole to stop and think about manners. Think about how they come across. I just went to the Dalton Ham Fest. Okay. And, I notice guys standing in a line looking at something, and another ham just literally pushed them right out of the way. And I noticed walking around outside, a guy would come by, and I would say, "Hey, how you doing?" You know, and he'd look at me like, "Who the heck are you? Why are you talking to me?"
Wow.
Yeah, you know, and ham radio is supposed to be a fraternity. I mean, that's what's really, that's the glue that's held it together, you know. And so, I mean, I don't know. And I guess I'm a big proponent. If you're on 75 meters at night, call CQ. You know, don't jump in the middle of some rag chew with a bunch of guys. Go create your own. Go off on some, you know, find you a blank spot on the dial. Get on there and call CQ. Be brave. Make a new friend. You know, and,
right.
You know, I really believe that'll grow the hobby. But I don't understand this, the abstinence of operation on 2 meters. Now, the reason I don't get on very much is just a matter of schedule and busy. I don't get on anything much. You know, I wish I could, but I can't. But the thing is when you do have time to operate, it's kind of nice to leave a radio on. And leave it on the repeater. You hear your friends come and go. You hear visitors and people coming in and out of town and whatnot. All that's just really cool. But I think it's something that's going begging today. This is something that is hurting the hobby. I think we need more activity, and I think it would be behoove a lot of hams to show themselves more friendly on the air.
And, I agree.
And less aggressive. And a little bit slower to anger and all that kind of thing. Because, boy, it seems to me what I'm hearing, I don't like what I'm hearing.
I mean, why would you want to go, why would you want to climb on the air with some operator who's going to just snap at you? I mean, you know, I have better things to do with my time than to listen to some guy snap at me because, you know, I'm either not part of a club or, you know, he just doesn't want me on the air or, you know, I'm wasting his time. I mean, people who monitor these repeaters, and then when someone comes on, they get snappy. It's like, well, then why are you monitoring in the first place? I mean, I thought you were monitoring it to hear someone come on and have a QSO, and, you know, if someone comes on and you snap at them and you wonder why they go away.
Well, you know, week after week, you hear us talk about Trans World Antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. Go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews, or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it, you'll get there. And read the reviews. See what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you.
I tuned into a frequency here the other day, and a guy came on running an old TR-4, TR-4C, I think it was. And, of course, he didn't have a readout, just an analog dial. So when he came on a little bit off frequency, you know. And right away, there's two of these guys just jumped him. Get on the frequency. If you can't get on the frequency, then get off. You know, and I thought, I remember a day when none of us were really on frequency. we were all teetering off center a little bit, you know. One guy sounded a little high, one guy sounded a little low. You know, that's just how it was, and you didn't really think nothing of it. Your ear just kind of adjusted to it. But, boy, they just chewed this poor fellow out. You know, I thought, well, the only way you could land dead center, you'd have to have a pretty accurate frequency readout on your rig. And, of course, all the new ones have that. But if you want to fire up an old Swan 350... You know, I mean, I don't understand that meanness. I mean, that was just mean. Those people, if you can't get on, you just get off. You know, we don't want to talk to you. I thought, wow.
And it's fun. It's ironic because, well, it's funny because, I mean, to defend some hams, I used to listen when I was out on Long Island, and you'd get some guys would get on and say, you know, how am I coming in? And, you know, a couple of the guys would get on and say, oh, you know, you're good, and or you have a problem. Can you adjust your antenna? And they would actually be patient, but then I would hear other people who would, you know, when they would climb on looking for, you know, reception reports, that they would either, no one would reply, or someone would get on and say, you know, this is not the place for things like that. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? It's, it, you know, the whole, you know, part of the hobby is, you know, is the art of, you know, installing and tuning up the radios and making sure that your signal not only, you know, is strong enough to reach the station that you want to communicate with.
But it's also open for the part of it is for experimentation, you know? I mean,
exactly.
You know, so, I mean, I hear guys that get on and they'll ask, how's my audio? What happens when I turn this? What happens when I turn that? You know, and they may drive some guys crazy on the frequency, you know, but it's still, that's all part of it. I mean, that's all part of the experimentation.
People are constantly trying to improve their audio path and their transmission, their radios and their transmitters, and their antenna systems to maximize, you know, maximize their communication.
Well, tell me something. How has amateur radio affected you in the professional broadcast engineering arena?
That's a good question.
Would you be as good an engineer today if you had never gotten into amateur radio?
See, I think if I hadn't been introduced to the police scanner and the CB radio and, you know, found out things about, you know, oh, you know, if I mag mount it to the, if I get a mag mount antenna for my CB, if I put it on my air conditioner, you know, I get a better ground plane and I get a better signal than if I would have just put it on top of my, you know, wooden dresser. You know, the small things you find out over time, as you discover, especially if you get into amateur radio as a young person, you know, and you read up on it and you take the test and you pass the test and you start experimenting with antennas and what works and what doesn't work and, you know, hopefully what doesn't blow you across the room because you didn't hook it up right. I think just as a whole, I think the excitement of being able to key the mic and being able to communicate on at first CB and then later the amateur radio, you know, it helped tremendously. Just drive my enthusiasm to find out more about, you know, radio in general and about, you know, how radio is created and how to maximize efficiency when setting up, you know, an amateur radio station. And, you know, a lot of what you learn about setting up an amateur radio station, you know, can be applied to broadcast radio, most definitely, from anywhere from antenna systems to like to STLs to RPUs, everything like that. I think they go hand in hand, you know, as you graduate from, you know, some people, you know, they're an amateur, it's a hobby, and, you know, they never really get into broadcasting, and we call those people millionaires, as opposed to the ones that actually catch the full radio bug and, you know, end up living paycheck to paycheck like we do. But, I totally think that amateur radio has helped foster the bug in a lot of people, and it comes from either, you know, that can be from, you know, it all starts at that point where you're either building, you know, homemade kits or you're building your own stuff or you're modifying stuff that you've purchased to make it better or to add a feature that, you know, didn't have. You know, I just think all of that builds up to, you know, to a possible career as an RF engineer.
Well, you know, I guess the question I'd have is, you know, when you were you know, it's a weird thing. So many guys remember the old Night Kit AM phono oscillator broadcaster. And there's so many people that I know that began to do some bootleg radio broadcasting. One way or the other, they were into that. Mm-hmm. And it seems like everybody that I know that is a radio engineer, that is a ham, that is in broadcast radio, has come down that path for some reason. Now, I want to know, did you ever have one of those old Night Kit broadcasters?
No, it's equivalent. When I was like 9 or 10, I had one of those Archer Radio Shack, you know, 20-in-1 hobby kits. And you could create everything from a little, you know, from a little LED light coming on to basic AM radio to signal generator, all these other things. You know, I was just enamored with radio, I guess, as far back as I was 4 or 5. And What's funny is I was more enamored with, believe it or not, the programming side of radio than actually the engineering at first, because I used to, when I used to go out to the stores, I used to buy 45s of songs I heard on the air, and then I would actually listen to the radio stations, and I would actually write on the record label radio stations I used to hear the records on. So if I picked up a record and I would see which radio stations, I would tune in to see maybe I could hear that record on this radio station. I would actually keep track of the radio stations and the records that they were playing. And I just, that was very unusual for someone who was 5 years old.
This reminder from PrayForMe.us. If you have a need in your life and you need someone to pray for you, go to the website PrayForMe.us. That's PrayForMe.us. You can remain anonymous, use a nickname, or just your first name. There's no financial requirements and no personal information needed. It's just people praying for people. If you have a need, go to PrayForMe.us. That's PrayForMe.us. Here at QSO, we really need to hear from you. We would appreciate it if you would go to our website, QSORadioshow.com. That's QSORadioshow.com. Send us an email from the website and put on that email, "I want to win," because we're constantly giving neat things away. QSORadioshow.com. Also, we'd appreciate it if you would follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And if you'd friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show. We'd love to hear from you. Be sure and do an email to us and put on that email, "I want to win." I guess we all grow up with, our own favorite radio stations when we were kids. What did you listen to? What was the transistor under the pillow phenomena? What was the stations you listened to, especially at night?
WNBC for sure. When I was a kid, I was also WABC, but it was towards the end of WABC's run as a top 40 station. So it was WNBC. It was a couple local FMs on Long Island, WBLI, which had a really strong signal near my house. It was a 50,000 watt class B, and we were only a couple miles from it. And the little GE AM/FM portable radio I had that, I used to take by my bedside, would kind of get overloaded, and I would only get a couple FM stations, and it was long before I knew I could get the city stations. And as I got older, I got, better radios, and I was able to pick up the city stations and, listening to the old Z100 when Scott Shannon first took over, WPLJ. And then I found a little oldie station up the dial that some of you may have heard of. It was WCBS-FM. And that's when I discovered Ron Lundy and Harry Harrison and all those guys. And that's when I finally figured out that this might be something I want to do, is, key the mic and be able to go on the air. And when that didn't work out, when I was a teenager, I actually started getting into the engineering side of it instead of the, why it's made, more of the how it's made. And my first radio station on Long Island, I was interested in the transmitter and the audio, and I started to fix things that were broken because the station really couldn't afford a full-time engineer. So when something broke, you basically started pulling it apart and doing trial and error, and eventually you either got it to work or you found a workaround. And I thought it was cool that guys would come in, and we were all paid $6-7 an hour. It wasn't a big deal. And guys would come in, and something that was broken yesterday was fixed, and they said, "Who fixed it?" And I said, "I did." And that's kind of how it got started.
Well, this whole thing with radio broadcasting, and I think ham radio too, short wave listening, all these things are so tied together, so kin to each other. And I think that once that gets into your life, but you keep it. I think it stays with you, but it's such a meaningful hobby. It's a lot different than most hobbies. I think that there's a certain magical thing about it. I know when I was a kid, I lost my dad when I was about 11, 12 years old, so I was an only child, and my room was in the basement of the house. But when I went into that room, when I opened the door and walked in there and closed the door, I had stepped into literally the rest of the world. I was connected to everywhere. And I remember when I was in school at 2 o'clock in the morning, there's somebody to talk to. You can't sleep. You want to wait. You get up. Hey, all you got to do is flip a switch, and you got somebody to talk to. And it's a hobby that I think is just unsurpassed. There's nothing that compares to it. But it's very difficult to get people in the general arena of life to understand that. Because when you say, well, you know, with this, I can talk to somebody on the Autobahn in Germany. I say, well, heck, I can do that with my cell phone. You know?
Yeah, but it's, yeah.
You know? But it's different. It's like comparing amateur radio to an online chat room. It's different. I mean, when you can hear a person's voice and you can hear the inflection in the voice, you can hear the emotional exchanges and all the things that go on. It's not like a chat room. You know, chat room and email leave so much to be desired as compared to voice communications. And when your voice communication is taking place on your own personal radio, and you've had some part of setting that up, maybe you built an antenna, maybe you built the radio, you know, and you realize that when you talk into that microphone, that's a signal that's traveling through the air direct to the other transmitter and the other receiver. You know, I mean, there's a certain thing that can't be duplicated. So when people say things like, well, I think that the computers have really taken a lot away from the hobby, I don't think so. I think that when people are introduced to this hobby, if they're introduced to it and they find out what it is, I think that it's a completely different ballgame than computer hobbyists. You know, I mean, I'm sure we do. We use computers an awful lot in ham radio. But it's a different kind of thing, you know, a different feel to it. And what I'm saying is that right now the number of amateur radio operators is up. We have more licensed hams now than we ever have, and yet we still are in the world of computers. So I think it's just a magical thing. It's magic is what it is. It's a certain kind of thing. I mean, when you look at old Hiram Percy Maxim sitting there with that pipe in his mouth, you know, and you see him sitting near this old vintage radio, and you understand that he was the creator of the ARRL, and he was also the creator of the Wolfhong and the Ready Snitch and all that. Then he was an inventor. You begin to get the picture. These are creative people. These are people who have imagination, you know. And I guess that's what I'm saying when I'm strolling through the Hamfest, you know, and people barely grunt and talk to each other. That's just not ham radio.
No.
Ham radio is Hiram Percy Maxim.
ham radio is communication. And don't get me wrong. There is no way I believe a computer can replace the experience of, you know, being able to basically just bring someone out of the air into your room, bring that person's voice and his thoughts and, you know, as he's communicating. That's one of the things. Is like I key the mic and, you know, I have the potential to be heard by all these people and to communicate with all these people. And there's nothing, there's no feeling like being able to, I mean, it still puts a skip in my step when no pun intended on our radio reception with the phrase skip, but it still puts, you know, I still get a thrill out of it when you make that connection. And if you have a good cue, you know, there's nothing like being able to key a mic and, you know, I'm being heard. I'm out there, you know. No, it's in real time. It's over the air. It's just out of the air. It's amazing, and it's nothing will ever replace that. And I, you know, there are more ham operators in license now than ever. I just wish more of them. I guess what I'm saying is, I wish more of them would, instead of booting up the computer at night, that they turn on the radio and try to talk to somebody.
You know, and there's some of the things about the modes today. The modes of ham radio. Something that I'm finding very, very interesting, and that is talking when I had conversations with some people. Like, for example, when the folks that were running Vibroplex were right next to us in the booth adjacent to us as we were doing a broadcast from the Huntsville Hamfest, and I began to talk to them, and they said, well, you know, since they dropped the code requirement, we really are selling more of these things than we were before, okay? And I thought, that's weird. Then I talked to Gordon West, and he said, well, Since they dropped the code requirement, boy, we're selling a whole lot more code training materials than we ever did before.
Really?
And so now, you know, you look at that and you say to yourself, well, how can that be? Well, this seems to be a consistent thing. When every time I talk to somebody that's involved with something they're selling involving CW, they're all saying the same thing. They're saying there is an extreme upturn in interest in CW on ham radio. Okay, now, when it was a requirement, I think it was like drudgery. you gotta learn the code, you know. And I don't know how many people I've heard say, well, you know, I just can't learn that code. There's just something. Of course, I think anybody can learn it.
Once they
get past their own blocks in their head that tells them they can't, and if somebody will sit down and work with you and send you the letters based on sound and not dots and dashes, it doesn't take any time at all, and you got it knocked. You may not be 25 words a minute in your head right away, but you've got it knocked, you know, well enough to where you can actually get on the air and communicate with it. I think that there's a reason why there's an increase in that. And then for Christmas, I got both of my boys, and I don't know what the things are. They're little boxes. Oh, boy. But anyways, they allow you to do Echolink and PSK and all that. You probably know what they are. I can't think of the name of the things.
I can't think of the name of the thing, but I know what you're talking about.
I guess they're the USB equivalent to a rig blaster, you know, whatever.
Okay.
So they got these things. And next thing I know, I got Matt calling me on the phone and said, wow, man, I made my first PSK contact. I said, really? And then he sits there and he tells me, boy, he's had it on PSK all night long. Man, there's all kinds of stuff going on. And he just, you know. And I got to thinking about that. I thought, see, here's a mode. This is just one little mode of ham radio. You know, and he's so excited about that. And then, you know, my son David will take the, he's got one of those TW2010 antennas, and he'll take it out to the park and set it up. And my grandson Brian will play on the slides. And David sets the TW2010 up with his little radio and sits there on a picnic table in the park and starts operating. And people gather around to watch what he's doing. You know.
See, that's cool. I mean, it's like then you hope that, you know, you get some people interested like that and some people, you know, watching something like that. And maybe one or two of those people will take something away from that and investigate and maybe, you know, go out and get their own license and be able to get on the air.
Well, I think ham radio has to be demonstrated. I know when I was young, the first time I ever saw ham radio demonstrated, actual demonstration, was in Dearborn, Michigan. And the gentleman's name was Nelson Cosby. I never can remember his call sign. But he made a contact with a guy in Denver, Colorado, and he was using a Heathkit Marauder and an SX-101 and a 20-meter beam. And, man, I thought that was something. You know, it looked like all that equipment on that table looked like a spaceship to me, you know. And I thought in my head, you know, I want to do that. You know, I don't know what all this is, but this is what I want to do. And I think that that's the key to it. We've got to demonstrate this hobby. I think it's they have to see it demonstrated. They have to see it in action.
Right.
It isn't a matter of just giving somebody a book or a pamphlet or something. They've got to see it demonstrated. And when they do, I think that's when the bug bites them. And if it gets a good bite on them, they're they're gone like you and I for life, you know.
There's nothing better than, you know, words, you know, can't, and pictures can't describe or even begin to show what it's like to make a communication like that and make a QSO, but then to be able to see something set up and watch it in action. It's just nothing like it.
All right. Now, let's talk a little bit about broadcast radio, because most hams that I know of, the people that are listening to this show, are radio junkies. You know, I mean, we're all the same. We all love radio. A lot of us grew up listening to all these 50-kilowatt AM stations. The younger ones may have missed out on all that, but they're still interested in radio, per se.
Right.
Now, I guess the question I have, and that is, in your radio career, as you have developed into that, what is it, I guess, that as far as the actual broadcast arena, What is it that really drew you in? What was the thing that attracted you? And you said, I want to be in the broadcasting business.
I think it's the, and especially the reason why I chose radio, I think it's the, or at least it used to be, the intimate connection that a radio station had with its listener. When I grew up, and when you grew up, and when people grew up during the golden age of music radio in the 60s and the 70s, you know, the radio station, whether it was through their own choice or whether they were just keeping with their commitment to news and information, would, you know, form a bond with the local community, with the people listening to the station. You know, a lot of that's gone now, and I think a lot of people treat radio and when they're listening to music station, you know, they go from station to station looking for a song they want, rather than staying with one station for a long period of time. I think a lot of that, people use radio now, and I know, unfortunately, I do. You know, I listen to particular shows, to certain shows on the radio. I'll tune into this station to hear this show, and I'll switch over to this station to hear another show. When, you know, back in the 80s when I was growing up, I would leave it on one station and listen for hours at a time because I was interested in the person who was on the air, and I knew the music was good, and that was satisfying. And now with all these voice-tracked radio stations and, you know, with all the, you know, 20 songs in the playlist, you know, radio's become very cookie-cutter. When I went to college, I went to a school that was very TV-oriented, and one of the professors came to me and said, you know, we have a great TV program here. Why are you interested in radio? And I asked him, I said, you know, what's your favorite radio station? And he gave me his favorite radio station, and I forget what it was. And then I said to him, okay, what's your favorite TV station? And he didn't have an answer for that. I said, I enjoy that bond between a listener and a radio station that you just don't get with TV. People bond to certain TV shows, but the actual broadcasting facility could be anything. There's not the romance between, you know, the actual TV station itself and the person is not as strong as the radio station. You know, there are radio stations in this country that people, you know, that people have grown up with, like WSM there in Nashville. You know, you tune in WSM, and you can just feel the history oozing out of the radio. You go down to, you know, when I visited in Nashville, you know, you drive up, and there's that WSM tower, and it's like the tower where all the towers have come from. It's the mother lode of towers, and the history and everything behind the radio station. I just don't get that same feeling from television. You know, people bond with television shows, but the television station itself is more of an appliance. The radio station, you know, it's part of the community. And you can have a small 1,000-watt AM station serving a small community and actually making a difference. And you get some TV stations that do that. But, you know, they do it only an hour or two a day during, like, a local newscast. The rest of the time it's some syndicated, you know, show or whatever. But a radio station, especially a good radio station, you know, at least 12 to 18 hours a day is a strong member of the community. And it's like a person in the community, and that's why that's what attracted me to radio, if I didn't get too long-winded there.
No, not at all. And matter of fact, I agree with you, because television stations are basically utility stations, it seems like to me. That's how I feel about them. A radio station is really part, oh gosh, of a community. It has its own image, its own thing, you know, and it's, you know,
it has a soul.
Yeah, and you know, it's like I know when I was a kid, you know, I used to listen to WKNR, Keener 13, had the transistor under my pillow, and I listened obviously to WXYZ in Detroit. All these stations, you know, they were on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But every time you tuned to that station, okay, you got WXYZ. You got WKNR, Keener 13, you know, and you became almost friends with them, you know.
Right.
And then, of course, when CKLW came along, which it basically owned the Detroit area, and people began, I mean, that thing was part of their life. Today, I run into people today, and if CKLW's call sign comes up, they will sing the jingle.
Mm-hmm.
They will sing it. I mean, in Nashville, Tennessee, I run into somebody that grew up in Detroit, Toledo, Cleveland, one of these cities, and we start talking about radio, and you say, did you ever listen to CKLW? And they'll sing the jingle. I mean, it's just crazy. I mean, it really is. That's the kind of impact. That is the kind of impact that that station has had, and stations like it. I mean, it's just like you were talking about the personalities in New York and stations like WABC and WNBC. They had a direct impact on the community. And you know, I think it's probably best illustrated when you watch the movie Pirate Radio. Have you ever watched the movie?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you see how the broadcasting from the pirate ship impacted so many people?
Yep.
I mean, impacted them in a lot of different ways. I mean, it would show these people listening in private. You know, some young gal's got her radio on and she's doing the dishes, but she's dancing along to the music and all this kind of stuff. I mean, television just doesn't reach out and do that kind of thing to people.
No.
You know.
No. That's the personal connection that you don't get with a television station. I mean, you get it with television shows, but not with the actual broadcast facility. I mean, these people, you know, and I love the movie Pirate Radio. I mean, I could have done more with I wish it was more radio eye candy than some of the other side stories, which, you know, didn't matter to me. But, I mean, the radio part of it was great. And a lot of these people, you know, that's the connection. I mean, it's the best program stations, no matter how big they are. You get a station like CKLW and how big it was. But to each individual person that was listening, they felt it was special to them. That this station is speaking to me and is connecting to me. And a good program, no matter how big the station is, a station like CKLW can make that connection on an individual level.
I guess the other thing too is that the station itself actually takes on a personality. You know, it's like a person. You know, on the dial, somebody that is part of your household now. It's in your car as you go to work. It's on. It's with you on the weekends, on Saturday and Sunday and whatnot. You know, and the people that are on the air, they're all part of that. They make up part of that picture. At least that's the way it was today. I don't know what's going on. You know, I tune in radio today. I'm bored to tears, and the arrogance of programmers today. What gets me is these guys call themselves consultants. Ask one of them what successful stations that they have in their portfolio. What station have you taken over, and what was it when you took it over, and what is it now? Yeah. And you know, you'll find out that the ownership places confidence in people with no track records.
Yeah.
No visible track records. And it never used to be like that. You know, never.
I don't get it. I look at that end of it. You know, people are, you know, nobody's creating, you know, that kind of radio that can impact people on multiple levels and have big ratings. I mean, there are some big rating stations are, but a lot of them are wallpaper. Everyone measures success by, you know, 0.2 of a rating point, a certain demo, you know, instead of, you know, in the days of CKLW, you know, when they had astronomical shares across all demos. Well, back then, the demos weren't even a big, it didn't matter if you were 12 or 72. If you were listening, you were a listener. And CKLW appealed to a wide range of people. And nowadays, success is measured by, you know, small age groups and 0.1 of a share. It's you know, I don't think there's anything, and everyone's afraid to do something creative, and that's why you have Ryan Seacrest on 200 stations. It's just not the same kind of radio as it was, and it's kind of sad. And I often wonder, you know, people have been, you know, young people today wouldn't know what we considered to be personality radio, where, you know, it was just not just listening, not just for the song you wanted to hear, but for the actual announcer, for the personality that was behind the microphone. You wanted to tune in, and you know, it was about the whole package together. And I think you know, young people today with, you know, with the way they've been brought up in a very, you know, instant demanding world, I don't know if they would even know how to appreciate something like that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I just, you know, to me, radio should be companionship and entertainment and information. You know, I mean, the guy on the air is supposed to be the, I guess I want to say the, there's a word. I can't think of what it is. But anyways, he's leading you through the hour. You know, right. He's your tour guide. That's what I was looking
there
for.
There you go.
He's your tour guide, you know. And when he plays a song, he should sell the song to you. In other words, if he's going to play Born to Be Wild by Steppenwolf, he ought to get right over the top of the ramp of that song and take you right into it, put you in the mood to hear that song.
Right.
Or tell you a little bit of... Tell you something about the song. Not talk your ears off, either. And that was one thing I loved about Bill Drake, because we could get all that done over the ramp of a record. Didn't have to stop the music and jaw for 25, 30 seconds. You know, you could do it over the ramp of a record. And I don't know. I mean, there's no tour guides. There's nobody doing a tour guide thing anymore. I mean, I don't know what people on the air are doing or thinking. But not just the tour guide thing, but also professionalism. Delivering a radio show from a person that actually sounds like they belong on the radio. I hear people on the air today, I swear to heavens, I think the guy, just before he got to the radio station, was running the checkout at Walmart.
Yeah.
Got no idea as to what he's doing. You know, I mean, and it shows. I think the audience responds when they feel like the radio station has respected them and put talent on the air.
I agree.
You know, and so you don't hear that. You don't hear that. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think it needs to be entertaining. It needs to be captivating. You know, not that everybody, I mean, and I've heard the other extreme. Boy, nothing makes me any more sick than to hear these guys go on about content for the sake of content. In other words, you got to get on and talk about the song. You got to give a whole bunch of useless information that nobody cares anything about. I say, shut up and play the music.
Yeah.
You know? And if it's something funny, it's something zany, it's something that entertains people, and more than anything else, if it's something that takes them away from their problems and makes them smile, then that's what you need to be doing. Here at QSO, we really need to hear from you. We would appreciate it if you would go to our website, QSORadioshow.com. That's QSORadioshow.com. Send us an email from the website. And put on that email, I want to win, because we're constantly giving neat things away. QSORadioshow.com. Also, we'd appreciate it if you would follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And if you'd friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show. We'd love to hear from you. Be sure and do an email to us and put on that email, I want to win.
Totally agree.
You know, I don't know. So
it should be an escape. Radio is supposed to be an escape. It's supposed to be, you know, it's supposed to bring you into this little, you know, it's supposed to make you feel something about either the music the guy's playing, or, you know, if he's got like a one liner, or if he's got like a little innuendo or something. You know, the masters of this, you know, got in and, you know, got it done over a 10-second intro, and, you know, they were masters at their craft. And nowadays, some of these people sound like they just dragged them off the street and put them in front. This is a microphone and just start, ugh. You know, a lot of these, you know, it's like they're just not.
Well, yeah, and I think what it is too.
It's formula.
It's
bad formula.
It's bad formula, but you know, and Bill Drake had formula, but gosh, all of those stations sounded great. You know, it's a matter of the people they're hiring. It's a matter of care if the radio station ownership caring enough about hiring professional people. You know, people who are going to have fun on that radio station, people who are going to turn it into something, and it's going to lead the audience with them, and everybody's going to feel good about the whole thing. I mean, that's the kind of people. But today, what I'm seeing is ownership is looking for the cheapest possible route out. In other words, their way of making more money is not creating more. and going out and selling more advertising and being more successful moving products off the shelf. The way this radio station management makes money today is by slicing and cutting every little edge that they can.
Yeah.
You know, let's cut it down. We don't have four lines anymore. We have only one line in the studio. You know, the secretary is part-time, and she only works half a day, okay?
How far can we push it? How cheap can we get it before it's totally full?
Well, I mean, you can go like this. You can sign off at midnight and maybe just sign on, you know, be like some of the restaurants that do just breakfast and dinner, you know, sign on for morning drive, sign on for afternoon drive, and keep it off the rest of the time. Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me, not in the least, it wouldn't surprise me if someone didn't come up with the idea to, wow, boy, you can really save a whole lot of money like this, you know.
Yeah, so. Don't get to the point where it's not, you can't afford, you know, that these people, they don't want to spend the money to run the station during the day. They think that it's a, you know, there's no return on investment, which is a famous, you know, oh, if we run it, there's no ROI in the midday.
But you were attracted into radio from the magic standpoint. All this other stuff that we're talking about now, that we're ranting about, you know, you were attracted into radio because it was just cool. You thought it was cool, and it was cool, and it attracted you in, and you listened to those radio stations, and you got acquainted with those people. Now, when did you first start getting the clue that it took a transmitter and, you know, equipment and an antenna and electricity to make all this work?
Probably when I was about 8 or 9, and I was in the Boy Scouts, and we got our first tour of that. I mentioned that station on Long Island, that FM station, WBLI, and we went down there and we saw the board and we saw the rack room with all the blinking lights, and I was like, wow, you know, I was like, look at everything that's needed to just put this song and this announcer on the air. Look at all the stuff they need to do all this, and it just fascinated me that, I guess my first thing was, why does it take so much stuff to, you know, just simply put a record on the air? And then, you know, I guess I started reading books about it. When I was about 13, I started actually hanging out at that first AM station where I ended up starting fixing things. And it just became, the transmitter and the antenna outside. And, you know, it was right outside the back door. And, you know, be able to basically see the whole method of which it was used to broadcast it from, the cart machine through the console and the microphone to the audio processor and the rack next to the Harris transmitter and the feed line going up and out and down into the basement and out the back door and, you know, under the parking lot to the tower in the backyard. It was all right there for me to see it. It was like a little microcosm of how radio was done. And that's how I first got my first taste of it.
How did you turn engineer? Tell me about that. Where did it go from?
How did I turn engineer?
Yeah, where did it go from being a kid fascinated with radio until where you were, you know, changing the final tube in a transmitter?
It was a necessity at the first station. A lot of it was, you know, they didn't afford to have a full-time engineer. The engineer was on a retainer. The chief operator, I think, was the general sales manager. And he knew about as much about, you know, he thought if you turn the light off over the transmitter, would shut the transmitter off. He was one of these guys. And stuff was broken. And I just got annoyed, I guess, with the fact that the radio station sounded bad. And we were still playing 45s. And, you know, I started by calibrating the tone arms. And then I started, you know, reading up on it and calibrating the tone arms. And then I started by, you know, we were obviously a mono AM station, and there were times where one channel of the song was missing in the mix, and, you know, late at night, you know, I'd open up the board and I would try to find the broken cable, the broken audio cable, and that's basically how it started, out of necessity, where, you know, I started getting an interest in fixing things that were broken, or finding out why they were broken and finding out ways to fixing them. And it just kind of grew from there, that I started doing more and more. And then when that station was sold, I actually took a year off in radio. I couldn't find a job anywhere. And then a friend of mine who had some connections with CBS, or actually at the time it was Infinity Broadcasting in New York, at WFAN, He was like, you know, you used to like to fix stuff. You know, they're looking for a summer relief engineer at WFAN. So, you know, I said I didn't think I had a chance, a snowball's chance, you know where. So I just put my resume in, and I ended up getting it.
So I guess when I'm talking to the ham radio community, I guess my point in all this is that the career in amateur radio, or the hobby itself in amateur radio, can literally take you into a professional engineering job. Because all the principles you learn, they're all the same. I mean, an SB220 tunes about the same as an AM station's final amplifier. You know?
It's just it's like, I'm trying to find a good analogy for it, but, you know, you start with, you know, it's just, you know, amateur radio, it's a smaller example of it, but the principles are the same.
I guess the question I would ask now, and that is this. What part of broadcast radio did you find, you know, for as engineering was concerned, what was it that intrigued you the most?
About the engineering side?
Yeah, engineering and RF, audio, that sort of thing.
The processing. definitely the audio processing. Another story from when I was young is, you know, when I used to listen to stations like Z100 and I'd go out and get the records, and I used to keep track of what stations were playing, what songs. You know, I would play the 45, and I was wondering how come it didn't sound as big and huge and bassy and, you know, it didn't just sound like radio. It sounded like it was flat and wimpy and, you know, no matter how.
Been down that road, gone down to the record store, got the record, brought it home, put it on the turntable and said, wow, what's wrong with this? This don't sound right.
Exactly. And my quest for wanting to know why the record sounded better on the radio, it ended up becoming the point where I wouldn't buy records anymore, and I would just tape songs off the radio, and I would listen to them off the radio because I preferred the way they sounded off the radio. And it wasn't until I got to my first station that they took me downstairs, you know, where the transmitter was, and there is a transmitter, and over to the right were these black boxes with all these little red and green and yellow LEDs. And I said, oh, what's that? And he's like, that's the audio processing. I said, what does that do? And he's like, well, what it does is it, it evens out the level and makes sure the level doesn't go up to a certain point. And that's when I realized that was what I wasn't hearing on my home stereo was that. And it was a bunch of old CRL processing. And that was my first introduction of equipment that actually manipulated the sound to give you that big radio sound.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the era that I came out of, when I don't know what I was listening to as a kid, I don't know what kind of processing that would have been. What was it, 1960? What would the Level Devils?
Level Devils or the original Automaxes or Volumaxes or the Solid Statesman.
Well, you know, I remember, I mean, the Automax Volumaxes, when I got into radio, those things were still in vogue. They were using those things. And that's the sound that you were hearing on the air. And they were not multi-band at all. They were single-band audio processors. And I remember one of them. I don't know if it's the Automax or the Volumax. One's an AGC and one's a limiter. Which one is which? Do you recall?
Right. The Automax is the AGC. The Volumax is the limiter. And the reason how I remember that is A is first, and you put the AGC first. And V is later in the alphabet, and you put the limiter later. That's how I remember that.
Well, I remember that the limiter, the Volumax, evidently, had some of them had switches on them. Mm-hmm. And they actually had an indication on that switch for 300% positive peak modulation. Now, there was not a transmitter on the planet that could do that. I mean, if you attempted that, if you were to attempt that, you would have fried your modulation transformer. Because I remember Ed Budabaugh over at CKLW trying to run hot positive peaks, and doggone near took a transmitter out. I mean, he almost completely melted down the modulator section of that thing, you know. But that those things had that switch on there. But you're right, because you would hear it, and there was gain reduction. And I don't know if they were doing anything at all as far as equalization, but all I know is that on the air, when you heard them play the 45 RPM record of the Safaris and Wipeout, mm-hmm. you know, when they would start that little drum piece in there, and especially like Keener in Detroit ran a little reverb, you know, that drum piece would almost sound like water dripping, you know, and
yeah.
And then that peak limiting and AGC action all going at the same time made that song sound bigger than life on AM radio. In other words, it just sounded big.
And the drums sounded like shotgun. It was sounding like cannons were going off. It was, you know, and it just made you want to crank it.
So you go to the record store, you buy that 45 RPM record, you bring it home and plop it on the turntable and play it, and you're saying, wow, that sounds dead, you know.
What happened? Did I get the right copy?
Well, you know, later down the road, though, that became a reaction that I had the first time I ever heard one of those Omnia processors. Because when they first came out, people were more concerned about adjusting them for cleanliness. And they sounded very kin to an actual live CD on the air. And you know what? I didn't like it. I wanted to hear processing. I wanted to hear gain reduction. I wanted to hear, you know, a little pumping going on there. You know, and it just wasn't there. They were loud, they were clean, but it sounded like a stark compact disc playing over the air, you know. And I think there's something to be said about what the right kind of processing does or adds, you know, to music. And
oh,
I think a processor can be musical. Well, now, for the sake of all of our listeners out there, because you are obviously an audio processor guru, because that's the business you're in, why don't you give us a little history of audio processing? And that is, who came first, the chicken or the egg, and what was it, and what was it they made, and how did it work? And let's just kind of go down that road a little bit.
Well, I guess, I mean, back in the 30s and 40s, when you'd actually have union engineers sitting at transmitter sites to prevent overmodulation, and the average level was about 25 to 30%, and now it's like 98%. You know, you had the early GE processors that were just basically just limiters that were just basically, you know, you just set them so that whenever the audio level would get to a certain point, it would just, you know, just start chopping it off, and that's all it really did. I think I don't even think the Automax and the Volumax was really designed in the stay level and all these earlier designs. I think they were more of a utility device that would that just accomplished something rather than created a signature. I think the audio signatures of those larger than life drums and everything else, that was like a happy side effect of those processors. I think that they were basically meant to just make the job of higher modulation, and you know, they weren't really meant to add anything. As a matter of fact, I think a lot of the older ads, you know, talked about how they were inaudible, and I think if you set them very conservatively, they did a good job and they were inaudible for their day. But I think a lot of people in the long quest for getting every last mile out of their signal, it would just start turning them up past what they were designed for, and you start getting all these side effects, and those side effects became what you know, the sound of music radio in the 60s, and then people started working with homebrew processing, and you know, then Ed Budabaugh at CKLW and came with the first multiband design that was used in, you know, in an everyday fashion for broadcast, and then later Mike Durow with the DAP 310, the three band processor, and then Bob Orban's all-in-one 8000 for FM with the stereo generator, preamplysis, and everything was designed as a package.
But where did Greg Olganowski come in?
Where did Greg come in? Greg, these guys were just, you know, everyone was looking for a way of building the better mousetrap. And Greg, you know, Greg had an idea for a tri-band audio processor for AM and designed it and built it. And then he had some very, very special FM boxes in the 80s that were highly coveted, and I think he had a deal where it was like a one-to-a-market, and he used to have people hide them behind, you know, smoked glass in the rack so people wouldn't see what your secret weapon was. And he basically came on with Bob when they were designing the 8200, if I recall correctly. But Bob Oganowski and even Frank Foti in his early days when he was hot rodding processors in Cleveland and then later in New York City, everyone was looking for that competitive edge. The Texar Audio Prisms were an answer to CRL's answer to Orban. You know, Orban had the 8000, CRL came out with a multiband FM box that was at the time extremely competitive, and CRL had a one-to-one market, and it ended up on in Pittsburgh, and Glenn Clark decided he needed to do something about it and design the Prisms to compete against it. So, I mean, everyone, all these guys are out trying to build a better mousetrap, and because of it, you know, everyone had an idea, you know, this guy had an idea for this, and this one had an idea for this, and as processing evolved, all these ideas eventually came together, and now you've got these big, expensive audio processors that basically are the legacy of these ideas that have been brought into digital and been perfected and changed and honed over the years.
Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN. TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com.
Well, I was going to say, I think I was trying to figure out who was first. I mean, Mike Duro or Greg Oganowski, one of the two entered the scene.
I think Duro was before Oganowski. Oganowski's box, I think, was mid-70s. Not to say that probably Greg was not doing things, on local levels or consulting for stations and, you know, hot-rodding boxes. There's a lot of people who never actually built a box. A lot of people, you know, I was an engineer. I never actually designed a single box like Greg or... You know, I would take this box and this box and this box and, you know, modify and adjust and put them together to try to create a system. Other people, you know, like Jim Somich was famous for doing that. And then later he moved on to, you know, modifying his own, modifying stock processors to have a certain texture. Frank Foti started out modifying, you know, his first major product was a modified Aphex Dominator. And then he later got into manufacturing his own processing on his own, an all-in-one box solution. And then he got together with, you know, Steve Church, and, you know, they got together to do the Omnia.fm, and, you know, it goes on from there for him. Bob Orban basically built things from scratch, basically from the beginning, from his first stereo enhancer that he sold to WOR in the late 60s up to his early designs that weren't really his prototype Optimod, which was built for a college station out in California, to the final product with Eric Small, who went on to form Modulation Sciences, the Optimod 8000. So, a lot of these guys came from tinkering to trying to find a better way to making their own way to, you know, becoming processing stars.
Here at QSO, we really need to hear from you. We would appreciate it if you would go to our website, QSORadioshow.com. That's QSORadioshow.com. Send us an email from the website and put on that email, I want to win, because we're constantly giving neat things away. QSORadioshow.com. Also, we'd appreciate it if you would follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And if you'd friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show. We'd love to hear from you. Be sure and do an email to us and put on that email, I want to win.
Well, I was going to say, I didn't know where Greg Oganowski came in. I know that the guy that started it all, the guy that actually kicked this whole thing off, was Ed Buttigieg. And mm-hmm. Ed built the very first multi-band audio processor for Bill Drake and for CKLW. And I know you and I have talked about that till the cows came home a couple nights. You know, he's telling the whole story about how all that happened.
Right.
Very, very intriguing to me.
I think Ed's design was the perfect blend of taking devices that are supposed to accomplish something and trading off that for, you know, getting a certain sonic texture out of processing and doing it in a very elegant way. And I think that was the forefront of modern, that was the foundation of modern processing.
It'd be interesting to make another one of those, but there were three, was it LA3s or LA4s? I don't know which.
Well, the LA4, it's probably LA4s. Those were the most, the LA4 compressor limiter.
There was three of those, and there was, you know, he had his own graphic circuit to divide the frequency bands. So right. That they would have a certain curve to them, you know, so they would they would cross over each other, but evenly. And then he followed that with a hard limiter, and I can't remember what the limiter was, but I just remember him putting the whole thing in the rack and doing all the twisty ties and soldering and all that kind of stuff. And when he got it together, I mean, I was like, I couldn't believe it. I thought, what is this? You know, what's it going to do? You know, and on the air, it was incredible. I mean, it worked the first time. It was hooked up. Put on the air, and I mean, he just tweaked it a little bit, and I mean, everybody was like amazed because it sounded so big. I mean, compared to Keener 13 and WXYZ, man, CKLW had this boom thump thing going on, man. You could hear that kick drum, and you could hear all this stuff. Of course, car radios back then, we had big old oval speakers mounted in the rear lid of the back seat, you know, and there was some real thumpy bass back then and whatnot, and it was interesting because all the rest of the stations, all the bass notes and all the things like the kick drums and all that, would take out the cymbals and take out the vocal and all that kind of thing. And by gosh, with that thing, it all held together. And of course, that was that was all history. But I remember the first Duro 3-band processor. By the way, just for the record, I own a 3-band Duro processor. I own a multi-band Gregg processor. And I also own an Optimod 8100 processor.
I've got a Duro. I've got a Duro actually sitting on a shelf. It needs a little TLC. I have an 8100. I've got some Aphex stuff, and I've got an Optimod. I've got some of the Vorsa stuff that we have.
No, I don't have anything modern like that. I just kind of collected, you know, over the years. And I do have, I think, in the garage somewhere, I have a Gates Level Devil. And, I remember those things, you know. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, but you're right. Back then, the Level Devil was designed just to ride gain, just so you didn't slam the transmitter. But they weren't very effective. I mean, none of those things really held held the negative peaks or held the entire envelope very right. well. They, I mean, stuff would creep over the top pretty quick. I mean, you couldn't, I remember when they first started doing this stuff for FM and some of the old nasty exciters they had, and they were using, obviously, two Automaxes and two Volumaxes, you know, stacked for stereo, and one would get to tracking off on its own somewhere, you know, and... Then I remember them having they came out with a model where you could strap left and right together.
Right.
And have them track at the same time. I thought that was kind of cool. But, you know, those things had these things in them called NuVistors. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the NuVistor?
Yep.
And I think there's a few of those things still around. I mean, a friend of mine told me, I wouldn't buy one of those for my station because they've got those NuVistors in them. And I'm thinking, well, they're so old.
I don't know if they're on. I don't know if they're on Optanium or not, but the old 400 series. Those are the ones that had those NuVistors in them.
Yeah, I don't know the Optimod 8100 when it came out. I'm not talking about the 8000. I'm talking about the 8100. And then they had the XT chassis for that thing and all that. And
But they, to me, the things always sounded muddy on the air. They just never seemed to have any dazzle, or they didn't, you know. But you could cheat. You could go into that XT chassis underneath and turn some screws and bring the brightness up on those things.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of messed up the time relationships as to how it did gain reduction. But I would much rather hear a little crisp, you know, high-frequency triangles and brushes and cymbals on the air than to hear whatever the heck it was they gave you before. Then, of course, now the Omnia processor came out. And Frank Foti with his Infinity 2000 when it first came out, you know, which were all. And those are all weird. I mean, to tell the folks a little bit about how those processors work. How are they different than an AGC, a limiter, multi-band, and all that? What's how does that stuff work?
Well, they're actually pretty. The all-in-one boxes, the early ones, were just basically a way of taking what people would have three or four different boxes in a rack, and they put them in one rack. And a lot of them had early attempts of being able to like have the certain sections kind of know what the other sections were doing, so that they work together as a system, like the Unity 2000 or the Omnia FM. The current processing that's out today is a lot more sophisticated as far as being able to, the AGC knows what the compressor is doing, and the compressor knows what the limiter is doing, and the clipper can, you know, figure out how deep into it is and can back down certain things. The early boxes, it's gone from being able to take all these different devices and putting them into one box, and now things run more as a system. I mean, it's truly a system where everything knows what everything else is doing. And it's kind of interesting to see how, you know, when you've got a situation where I am, where, you know, you can listen to the original, the older designs, and then switch to, you know, the modern design, and just see how much more louder for the same amount of subjective distortion, you know, you can make a processor today. And, you know, on one side, you're like, wow, that's raw power. On the other side, it's like, I can create this really nice, clean, open sound that is just all loud, but it's just nice and clean and very natural sounding at the same time. So there's a lot of wiggle room when it comes to audio processing today to be able to use these systems and to, they're actually audio processing systems is really what they are, as opposed to the old individual boxes that were stacked together, or the all-in-one boxes, which were, you know, took all those stacked-together boxes and put them all in one enclosure, but hadn't really refined how they interact with each other. Now they interact, and they work very well together.
Well, I guess the thing of it is I don't think a lot of folks understand and know exactly what multi-band audio processing is. So why don't you explain that? And then talk about the method that Frank Foti used in the processor, the Omnia and the Infinity 2000, that made that so much more, I guess I want to say, unusual and set it apart from the other processors at the time.
The when you're dealing with multiband, for someone, you know, for people who don't understand, you're basically splitting the audio up into different compressors that handle each band, instead of having one compressor that handles bass, mid-range, treble, and presence. You've got a different band for each one of those. So this way, when you've got maybe a song that's lacking in bass a little bit, the bass compressor can, you know, release a little bit and add a little more bass into it. Or if there's too much bass, the bass compressor can reduce that without the other parts of the audio spectrum being inhibited, because that bass compressor has to work harder. That's a very simplistic definition for multiband. It's basically each band has its own processor, and those bands are then summed back together into a final limiter to prevent any overshoot from recombining those bands. And then you've got your preemphasis and any kind of clipping that prevents, you know, the transmitter from being overmodulated and the audio being distorted in a negative way on your radio. You know, we talk about audio processing, about the different types of distortion. When you have, you know, distortion being, you know, something negative, and distortion being something positive, the whole idea of audio processing is taking a specific sound and changing it and distorting it, per se, in a certain way to make it sound a certain way. That's the kind of distortion that we like. The kind of distortion we don't like is the overmodulation or too much clipping. Now, one of the things that made the early Omnia products, back then known as Cutting Edge, different was the way it was and how preemphasis was dealt with. In the Orban processors, preemphasis was accomplished before the multiband. And for those who don't understand what preemphasis is, it's a high-frequency curve that's added to the signal, and then there's a complementary de-emphasis curve in the receiver, and the idea was to increase the signal-to-noise ratio of the upper end, especially for stereo broadcast. Orban decided to put the preemphasis curve before the limiter so that the preemphasis would be delivered to the limiter with all the other programming, and the limiter could protect the preemphasis from distorting into the final clipper. Frank Foti developed the system where preemphasis, and I don't believe he was the first, because there's been a lot of crude processing in the 60s, 70s, and even the 80s where preemphasis was after limiting, and it was just a mess because it was just overshooting. But Frank developed a way to have preemphasis after the limiter so that the limiter wasn't constantly working on the high-end preemphasis curve, so that the audio sounded more natural. And that was the first time. It was almost like when you first heard that, the high-end sounded like, you know, someone had just taken a towel off the tweeter, and all of a sudden all this detail on the high-end, which before had either been grossly distorted on FM or had been limited to death, now all of a sudden that was like right up front and wasn't distorted like it used to be.
I that was one of the things I first noticed when I went to New York City and heard Omnias on the air. I thought, how are they getting these crisp high frequencies? This sounds so good.
Yeah. That was a big, and you know, Orban still designs their processor with the preemphasis before, and there's a huge market because there are people who like that sound. It's a very warm sound, and it's a very safe sound, because if you ever listen to an Orban processor, you know, unless it's grossly misadjusted, it's very hard to get sibilance and tearing in the high end out of it. In an Omnia processor, it's a lot easier to do that because of, you know, just the controls, but you know, most of the factory presets are set so that, you know, you're not going to get into trouble. In our box, we give you the option, and the Vorsys, all the Vorsys processors give you the option of actually placing the preemphasis where you want it. So you can either have it before or after the limiter. So
okay, now you
schools of thought.
I was going to say one thing that you've left out here, and I want you to explain this, because all the claim to fame with Omnia has been this look ahead mm-hmm. processing. So tell everyone, because I believe there's some of that is being used now in amateur radio mic processors and things. But talk about look ahead. What does that mean? Look ahead processing.
Look ahead. It means that the audio is actually delayed by a certain amount, whatever I guess the circuit would need to be able to limit it. And it's basically it's delaying the audio so that the limiter or whatever device is actually working on the audio has a little extra chance of being able to make intelligent changes to the audio in gain, rather than just have it being like what I used to call a dumb over a threshold limiter or a dumb over a threshold AGC. It's able to actually almost like it's like being able to in a digital processor's mind being able to freeze time and work on the signal and then press play again and then wait for the next peak and do the same thing. It, you know, when you add look ahead, the limiter is more accurate. Anytime you have more time to work on something in the processing domain, it's going to be accurate. The downside is that when you add delay, monitoring in real time becomes an issue. So there's this trade-off between how much look ahead and how much latency you want to build into the device.
Well, latency is pretty part of a weird thing. I mean, I'd never encountered that before in radio, that all of a sudden these devices came out that delayed everything. So you're
right.
So used to hearing yourself in the headphones in all the processing, all the real-time analog audio processing. Now comes these audio processors that are operating off of digital DSP chips and stuff. But in order to accomplish all this incredible audio processing, the trade-off is there's a delay.
Yeah.
And you now hear yourself about a quarter of a second or however long it is. I don't know how long the delay is, but there is a delay there, and it can be distracting on the air if you're trying to listen to yourself through a pair of headphones.
There's been this. I remember when Orban first came out with the 8400, and the delay was something like 50 milliseconds, which doesn't seem like a long time, but when you're listening in headphones, 50 milliseconds, I dare anyone to try to talk into an audio processor with 50 millisecond delay. All of a sudden, they'll start talking slower because then their brain starts trying to listen to themselves because the difference in time between what you're hearing, you know, in your head and what's actually playing back in the headphones is so much that you actually start, your mind subconsciously starts concentrating on the audio coming back through the headphones 50 milliseconds later, and it will actually cause you to stumble. And that was a big deal. 50 milliseconds was like, everyone was like, this was blasphemy, and, you know, how can you do that? And Orban's take at the time was, you know, the advent of HD radio was around the corner. Most HD stations have 8 to 10 seconds of delay on the air in order to create the HD signal. So Bob's idea was that, you know, real-time off-the-air monitoring is going to go away. Why not use that time, that look-ahead time, to make a more accurate audio process, make a more accurate limiter, make a more accurate clipper? And there was a lot of merit to what he said, because now the original, it's funny, from there, Orban started to get the latency down as he improved his design on the 8400 code. The latency got less and less, and then he started making trade-offs between clean audio and low latency. And if anyone's ever looked at an 8400 or even an 8500, there are presets that are standard, and then there's presets that have LL next to them for low latency. So basically, you were able to trade off brightness, loudness, cleanness, and time. And time became the fourth factor. So if you had a longer time, the trade-off between brightness, loudness, and cleanness was less of an issue. The less time you had, the more of an issue was to trade off those three other factors. Nowadays, you know, there's new processors that have almost up to a second of delay on the air before they even go into the HD exciter. So now you've got, people have come to the realization that real time has become a thing of the past, and now the goal is to delay the time to get the best possible sound.
I was going to say, now, we entered into an era now with this Air Aura processor. In other words, I'll be honest with you. To me, the Omnia had stole the show as far as Orban was concerned. Some people still love the Orban processor, but, you know, I listened to them, and I couldn't hear the high frequencies as clear and as crisp and as pristine coming out on the air out of the Orban stuff as I was hearing out of the Omnia stuff. Now, the Omnia stuff can be adjusted, like you were saying. It can become a sonic horror show.
Right.
If a person is not careful. But that was what I heard. And I guess it's probably because, like you were saying, the pre-emphasis was put on last instead of first on the Orban.
That was a big deal.
Yeah, on the Orban processors, it was prior to and then processing. Now,
right.
But you guys have come up with something new, and this thing is called the Air Aura. You've also got some other smaller processors that amateurs may very much be interested in putting on their AM transmitters or even on their single sideband, because there's a lot of guys that are really into high quality sideband audio.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the Air Aura is a completely different concept in processing. It confuses the daylights out of me, but for the money, I'm telling you, it's the best thing I've heard on the air. It is so clean, it is so musical, and it maintains loudness, but not to the point where it's, you know, it's whacking you in the head. Describe this thing. How did it come about? How is it different, say, for example, than the Omnia processor? And, you know, tell us a little bit about that and its development and whatnot.
Well, the whole idea behind the original Vorsys line and first product was the AP1000 was to design a processor. And the Orban had a certain sound. And even though the Omnia came out and was, at the time, declared a very neutral-sounding processor, over time, you know, as people listen, you know, you could tell an Omnia processor was an Omnia processor when you heard it on the air. The idea was to give the users tools to be able to create whatever type of sonic texture they wanted. And that was the original idea behind the original Voices AP1000, and that evolved into the AP2000, and things were added. There was our SST algorithm was added, which was the first truly interactive AGC that basically interacted with the other parts of the audio processor. Well,
why don't you explain a little bit about what these processors are and how they work? In other words, what made these processors up? Because I know in the rack, they certainly were very colorful, a lot of colors flashing on and off. But what was behind those boxes?
Well, the idea behind the boxes were we took the design of the SST circuit, which stands for sweet spot technology. And what it does is it analyzes the incoming signal, and it knows a bunch of things about how the user has set the processor up. It knows about the settings of the compressor. It knows about the state of the compressor, whether it's into how much gain reduction and whether it's close to gating and what the compression ratio is. And it knows the output of the compressor. It knows what the level is of the output. And it's able to make on-the-fly calculations and adjustments to the compressor in real time that basically were not possible in previous designs of anyone's audio processor. Instead of just hanging the AGC on the front of the compressor, we designed a gain circuit that looked at multiple states and is able to make adjustments where it feels it needs to. And over time, between the AP2000 and the Aurora, and now our new version of Aurora 2.0, we've been able to refine that and make it even more bulletproof.
Now, the Aurora 2.0, was that involving a hardware change or a software change?
Total software. Aurora 2.0 is a software change. It takes about 20 seconds to upload, reboot the box, and then you're running the new software, which has an improved clipper in the back end, has improved bass response, and has more improvements in our GUI, and has more improvements to how the SST works and to the user controls and how they can adjust the the compressor and the SST to interact with each other.
Well, tell me a little bit. This thing has how many bands of processing?
It has 5 bands of compression and 5 bands of AGC, and it has a 31-band limiter. And if you think about 31 bands, and that sounds like a lot, one of the ways we ask people to think about it is if you look at television and think about lines of resolution in a television picture. And, you know, the NTSC 535 lines of resolution versus an HD picture. More lines of resolution equals a finer picture. More megapixels equals a finer photograph. 31 bands is not hard to do in digital domain. And a lot of people look at 31 bands and try to put it in terms of analog and how many filters and how much of this. In digital, it's not a big deal at all. It's actually a very efficient code. And it's not the biggest code hog in the box. The 31-band limiter has no gating. It's meant to do a dB or two of gain reduction in individual bands. And it's basically meant to get in, do the limiting it needs to do to let the clipper be more open, and then get out. So it ends up being where you don't hear the limiter because you only got a band or two in gain reduction. And because only a band or two out of 31 are in gain reduction, there's less percentage of the audio spectrum is being limited. Thus, there's less limiting going on over the entire audio spectrum. It's like, you know, it's actually when you sit down and think about it in its most basic form, it actually makes a lot of sense. The reason why it's never been done before, because in analog, you would need about 3 racks full of gear in order to accomplish it. In digital, it's really a piece of cake.
Okay, now let me ask you a question. What's it going to take to get Wheatstone or somebody there to start manufacturing some amateur radio audio processors?
Well, we have a very low cost audio processor that does FM, AM, or HD streaming, and the AM processor we actually have some amateur operators who have used it. There's a couple in Ohio. There's a friend of mine on Long Island who uses one. They use it on HF, and they're very, very pleased with it. It's some of the best contacts and best experience with their audio has been using this processor. It gets out, it cuts through, it's loud as all get out, but it's not distorted. It's very natural sounding, and they've been very happy with it. And a lot of people are like, well, no one would ever spend that much money. You can just get an old limiter or find something. But, you know, for those who are really serious about, you know, operating in those bands, a powerful processor like the VP8 Plus, which is the multi-mode processor we have, it can actually make a huge difference when you're trying to make contacts or if you're contesting and you're using a sophisticated piece of equipment like that.
Well, I mean, what differences would you say you would hear on the air listening to someone on HF running one of these things, and then let's say they turn it off? What would be the change in the audio?
Well, the ability, because the VPA has an 8-band limiter as opposed to the 31, what you could do is, I mean, the 8-band limiter allows you to... You can process specific bands heavily to try to get through the noise. And, you know, if you wanted to, let's say, you know, you wanted to, you know, have a lot of mid-range boost to get above the noise, the VP8 will allow you to set the processing to get above the noise. But because the limiters are digital and because there's 8 bands of them and the processing is so refined, what you get is you get into what we call heavy limiting without the heavy limiting sound. You know, it won't sound like it's heavily limited. It'll just sound like it's loud, and it'll sound like it's above the noise, and it will sound like it cuts through. You'd be able, with using the 8-band limiter in VP8, you'd be able to make out a communication, especially if the signal's not so good. You'd be able to make them out through the fading and through the noise, and maybe through some adjacent sideband chatter, you'd be able to get cut better than you with a standard wide limiter.
So that's the key to that. Well, I remember long ago there was a bunch of articles in QST where there were different approaches to audio, and they were the things that were called like talk power and things like that, where it would process the low frequencies one way, and then it would process the consonant sounds. I remember reading that, and I was so confused as a kid trying to figure out what all that was. You know, what they mean by that, you know? And then, of course, have you ever heard any of Bob Heil's audio seminars? You ever heard him talk and talk about the Fletcher-Munson curve and the HC4 mic cartridge and how it sounds and all that kind of thing? Have you ever heard any of those?
I've not heard any. Unfortunately, I've not heard any seminars. But Bob's microphones not only making a huge difference in amateur radio, but now in even broadcast. You know, Bob's got. You know, I'm blown away by the PL30 and the PL40. They're tremendous microphones, especially for broadcast. And you know his microphones that are tailored more for amateur radio, you know, they cut through on their own even with, you know, your standard amateur equipment, and then you add sophisticated processing on top of that, and you know watch out.
Well, you know, I guess I was going to say these mics that he makes. I'm on a PR40 right now. That's what I'm talking on. These microphones have certain characteristics to them. But I guess the question I've got is, when you add this processing like what you have to the human voice, and I'm sure you guys have had to do some sort of study on, you know, intelligibility. Like, what do you do to increase the intelligibility of the human voice in adverse conditions?
Right.
And so I guess my question is, why don't you talk about that a little bit? What is it that the processing does in order to other than making a frequency response change, where like the Heil cartridges and the microphones just simply take the bottom out and they overemphasize mid-range and highs, so it tends to punch through. But now an audio processor with DSP has got a little bit different approach to that.
it, you know, it increases the intelligibility in a different way. And, you know, actually will maintain a full band of frequencies while it's doing it. So you don't necessarily have to sound like Chip Margelli used to say. It doesn't sound like your shorts are too tight. Right. How does that happen? Or how would that increase the intelligibility? I know it does, but I just don't know how to describe it.
Well, what it does, I mean, when you take a processor like the VPA and you tune it up for whatever band, whatever type of band conditions that you're and bandwidth that you're using, to be able to, I mean, it itself can do those kinds of filters. It's got the low pass filter it has a low pass filter available for AM or for HF or for even shortwave. And basically what it does is it's able to, you know, because it's got so many bands in the limiter, because it's got eight bands, just like I was talking about with the 31 band limiter, where you end up with only one or two bands out of eight in gain reduction, as opposed to a more processor that's maybe only two or three bands, and when you got one band into gain reduction, that's almost like half the audio spectrum. The narrower the bandwidth, you know, the more critical everything becomes when you're doing audio limiting. If you've got a wide band limiter, you know, all you're going to do to get more loudness is you're just going to be packing all that audio against the wall. If you've got multi-band limiting and you're dealing with limited bandwidth, you know, you have the benefit of having only like one or two bands into gain reduction, and the audio that's not being limited ends up, you know, passing through onto the air without being touched. So at any given time, the audio around the few bands that's being limited, you know, is still kept up at a high level because, you know, there's no gain reduction happening on it. So what ends up happening is that the limiting is not as noticeable, but the level is still pretty loud. Because the limiting is not noticeable, you know, it doesn't start trashing or destroying the voice. The voice maintains the, you know, as much of the original source being, you know, what's actually coming out of the speaker. The speaker meaning the person talking, it maintains more of what the person who's talking is. It sounds like it's more natural sounding on the air, yet it's a high level, and it's more intelligible, rather than just having just this, you know, pump and suck limiter that just keeps squashing down on the audio, which makes it hard to pick the guy out of the noise.
And most of the most of the mic processing that's used for amateur radio now, from what I can see, I don't think there's any multi-band stuff. I think most of it is single-band compressors.
Most of the mic processing is single-band. We do have a mic processor that is one, two, or three band.
No, I'm talking about stuff that's being sold for amateur radio.
Amateur, right? For amateur, no, it's all that's still wideband. All that's still wideband, and I guess it's. I mean, I don't know why there isn't more like maybe two or three band stuff for amateur radio. I know a lot of operators who have adapted broadcast limiters, like some of the old CRL stuff, which is two and three band. And they're using that for HF, but why it hasn't sold for, why, you know, you don't have amateur radio companies making amateur radio limiters that are multi-band, I don't know why. I think it would benefit, but I guess it's supply and demand, people who are looking for multiband have found ways to adapt.
It could have to do with cost, too. I mean, the amount of cost it takes. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. All right. Now, we've talked this one down the phone pole here. I'm going to shift gears here real quick. You are, at this point, you're a radio engineer. You work for Wheatstone Corporation. It makes broadcast consoles. Right. They make the audio processors. What else does Wheatstone make?
We make audio processors, consoles for radio and TV, and we make routing systems for radio, TV, and for live sound and for like public address systems in stadiums and facilities like that. So we have a whole bunch of different options for consoles. We have IP-based audio consoles. We have TDM-based consoles for radio and television. And we still even make standalone analog consoles and standalone digital consoles for people who aren't into that IP and routing stuff and, you know, okay. Just basically want a small console for a studio.
Okay, we're talking about audio traveling over IP. Describe that just briefly to everyone. What is audio over IP?
Well, basically, every source has an address, and basically you're able to route over Cat5, we use a gigabit switch, it's just a easy way of being able to wire, assign, and route audio across a 5 or 6 station facility, and to be able just to manage it without having racks and racks and racks of 66 blocks, like we used to have to do in the bad old days. It's a very easy way. Our system is, we like the merits of our system very much. It's we have nodes that live with the consoles. We have interchangeable nodes that if we have a failure or need to make a hardware change, what's the word I'm looking for? I have to apologize. It's late. The profile. Thank you. The profile is stored so that way, you know, each node or blade knows what the system is about. So when you put a new node in, it goes out. A new blade in, it goes out and says, "Okay, I'm blade number whatever, and you know I'm supposed to do this, 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 and this," and it loads its configuration. So I mean, there's a lot of flexibility built with these systems. It's really amazing how far it's come from patch bays to being able to distribute audio like this. And a lot, you know, it's all, you know, you're streaming audio point to point. And you know, our processors, the Aurora now has a way of, you can use IP audio streaming to go into the processing, and you can actually have a rack, you have a processor sitting in a rack with a Cat5 cable going to it, and that's all. It's actually gotten to be quite phenomenal what you can do with IP-based audio.
Okay, now, getting away from the rest of all of that, you are married.
Yes.
And you are married to a radio engineer.
Yes.
And I forgot to ask you this question, and I can't remember because I know when we visit, is your wife also a ham?
Yes.
Okay, so now, let's go down that road. How did you meet her, and how did you wind up together? And tell me a little bit about the commonality and her career as far as engineering is concerned, and her likes and dislikes of amateur radio, what she's into.
We actually met at an SBE meeting in New York at WOR. And it basically came to a thing where she was posting on a forum that she had been in radio when she got out of radio. And she was interested in doing something in radio again. And she was interested in the engineering side. She restores old radios and old electronic amplifiers and things like that. So she was posting, and I said, if you're interested in the engineering aspect, you should join the SBE and come to a couple meetings because, you know, most of the major engineers in the market in New York City, you know, would congregate at these SBE meetings once a month. And if you wanted to, you know, latch on someplace, this would be a good place to network. So she showed up, and basically things went from there, you know. She and I just started, you know, going around to transmitter sites, and one thing led to another. It was kind of very interesting romance through engineering.
There you
and
go.
She ended up getting involved at Bloomberg Radio, and she ended up working at United Stations in New York City. And she's now moved down with me when I left CBS a year and a half ago. And she and I moved down to North Carolina, and she now works at Wheatstone doing quality control. And basically the stuff she tests, I take out the field.
Wow. So she's into amateur radio.
Yes. Wasn't at first. Actually, it's funny. She's not as active as I am, and I don't think she's ever been as active. Rather than how it gets on the air, she's more into the repairing of the studio equipment and the radio. She's more into the receiver end of it, repairing the receivers, and, you know, she restores the old tube radios. And, you know, I guess part of it is she is not. I mean, I don't want. She is a little shy on the radio, and, you know, I guess having a hard time finding or trying to have a conversation or trying to find something to say. And there are times I get on the radio, and it's kind of like, you know, you're trying to create a conversation where sometimes there isn't, then other times just everything just flows. But, you know, she's just done VHF. You know, she's got an ICOM, and she's got a Yaesu, a little HT. And, you know, she's used it, and, you know, we've talked down here every now and then. But it's just not something that I don't think she's as into as I was. I think she's more into the broadcast side than the amateur side of radio and its history. And, you know, she likes old tube transmitters. You know, when I go out on the road, if I'm doing an AM station, I'll take a picture of the old aux transmitter, and it's some Gates or RCA or Collins transmitter, and that's the kind of stuff she likes.
I see. Well, that's very cool that y'all can share, and both of you working at Wheatstone and everything. That's just very, very cool. And I have to compliment you for that. That's, you know, and both of you being in ham radio, that's another really, really cool thing. Listen, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for joining us and talking and coming on QSO today. And of course, we, you know, when you get into radio, there isn't any aspect of it that the folks that listen to this show are not into. I mean, everybody's into everything. If all it has to do is emit RF, and you got our attention. So, but thank you so much, Mike, for coming on board and talking with us.
I appreciate you having me.
Here at QSO, we really need to hear from you. We would appreciate it if you would go to our website, QSORadioshow.com. That's QSORadioshow.com. Send us an email from the website and put on that email, "I want to win," because we're constantly giving neat things away. QSORadioshow.com. Also, we'd appreciate it if you would follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And if you'd friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show. We'd love to hear from you.
be sure and do an email to us and put on that email, I want to win.